This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we're going to be discussing the economics and feasibility of adding storage to municipal projects. So Rick Brown from Terra Verde Energy is going to start us off on the topic, and then we'll have open discussion. Go ahead.
Sounds good. Thanks, Sierra. So just to give you some context, Terra Verde Energy works with public agencies to help figure out the feasibility of solar and or solar plus storage and or standalone storage. And when I say public sector, schools, cities, counties, water agencies, transit districts, and so forth, anybody who's in a public service. So in my discussion here, I'm going to be looking at it from a broad perspective. If the project looks feasible from an economic standpoint, and that's what I'll talk about is how we look at that, then we move into the phase of putting together bid specifications, running RFP processes, getting the market to compete, which is an important part of economic feasibility, and then making sure that the contract process and implementation process is done as cost effectively as possible. And an important other piece of the economics of these storage projects is making sure you have good ongoing asset management, meaning both monitoring those systems, make sure they're operating the way they're supposed to, and doing the required maintenance, be it corrective maintenance, preventive maintenance, and so forth. And then obviously doing annual reporting to make sure you're actually getting the economic benefit that you were promised. Sometimes that's something that you do through your battery provider. Sometimes you have a third party. But all those phases are critical in evaluating the economics of these projects. So let's start with the feasibility.
Excuse me, Rick. This is Jeff Hinsky. Soros here. I was late. I had all kinds of dial-in problems. I could hear you, and you couldn't hear me, and then I couldn't hear anybody. And anyway, I'm on, and I'm listening in, and I'll jump in when it's my turn.
Yeah, I'm gonna be real quick here because I'm mostly right now start with just talking about the front end of figuring out where are the economics for battery storage projects. And to be honest, I'm only gonna be able to right now look at it through the lens of the California policy and market situation because that's what I'm familiar with. But my guess is that some of the principles in terms of what we look at here are either in place in other markets and other policy regimes, or they're likely to come there at some point. In California, the main benefit for a municipality is their ability to reduce their demand charges. Now, in California, you've got two major parts of your bill. You've got your generation or volumetric charges, your KWH. You also have your demand charges. And those demand charges are based on the 1 15-minute interval in a month when your peak demand is the greatest. Okay. Now, ideally, if you have solar already on your facility, if that peak occurs within that parabola of when solar is actually generating its power, your solar is effectively reducing that peak and therefore reducing what that cost would be. But there is the reality that sometimes an inverter goes down, and if your peak is at a time when your solar was supposed to be operating, you may end up getting a big charge because, again, that solar wasn't able to shave off that peak demand. And so you're going to pay that high amount based on that 15-minute interval when the solar was not operating. But there's also situations where the peak demand is occurring outside of the ideal solar production curve. You may be in a situation where you have a facility that has a huge amount of demand, say in the early morning, as part of their startup operations, maybe a water facility or a wastewater treatment plant, and the solar is just not cranking enough to do that. Or you may have a situation in the afternoon or evening if you have, you know, operations going into the early evening when the sun's going down. Again, you don't have the solar to offset the demand. That's when having the battery paired with your solar allows you to either shave off those peaks that are outside of that ideal production curve, or as backup, if the solar does go down at a time when there's also a peak, that battery can come in and shave off that peak and therefore reduce the charge that you might have. Now, That's the demand savings. Now, just to give you some sort of where the complexity comes in California, we in one of our major utility territories, PG&E, we have a rate structure called A6 that actually is very used by a lot of people, a lot of municipalities, for when they went solar, because its rate structure is such that solar, it's particularly friendly to a solar facility. And one of the things that makes it friendly is that there are no demand charges. So if you're on A6 in Northern California and PG&E territory, the benefit of adding battery storage as a demand charge saving goes away. You don't, there's no demand charge to eliminate. And so it's not a value there. Now, in the other large utility territories, Edison and San Diego Gas Electric, they do have demand charges and it can benefit. But even so, the critical piece here is that depending on the shape of your demand curve, the batteries may or may not be economically beneficial. If you have a demand situation where you have what we call a brick, where you have high demand for, say, a 2 or 3 hour period, it's going to be pretty hard to have a battery project pencil, because to have a battery that's going to discharge and shave off a very flat, high level of demand, it's not going to be cost effective. The situation where a battery can be most cost effective is you have relatively short duration peaks, maybe 15 minutes, maybe 30, as much as an hour, and that battery can then shave off those peaks and get you those good economics. Now, that's demand charges, and that's historically been the best part of the economics of a battery. You can also have a situation where solar doesn't make sense. And we have a number of sites where solar, the generation charge component was not really that beneficial having solar, but the facility did have some peaks in their demand such that a standalone battery actually made sense. Now, right now, if you pair storage with solar, you can get the ITC, you can get the investment tax credit, which reduces the cost of your overall system, obviously. Right now, you can't get that ITC for a standalone battery. The other economic component is some states, but for example, California, has an incentive for batteries. And what a level of incentive you get for that battery does have some influence in terms of how that battery is being used. I won't go into all the details, but if you have questions later, I can talk about that. But one of the areas I should talk about in terms of benefit is the two other areas that you can think about are rate arbitrage. There are some situations where by charging the battery with your solar, say when you're in the afternoon, when costs are relatively low because you've got your solar reducing your cost of energy, you can then discharge that battery potentially during the evening ramp or evening peak. Now, most markets haven't gone there yet, but California is now gone to a place where the peak period is from 4 to 9, because we have so much solar now in our portfolio that in terms of the supply-demand dynamics, we have a shortage of power, of clean power from 4 to 9, as opposed to the afternoon, which has been the first historical peak. So you can use that battery to essentially shift your cheap solar energy from the afternoon and discharge it in the evening to reduce your, again, volumetric charges. So that's something that is likely to come as other markets get higher and higher penetrations of solar. And then finally, the last bit of economics, and this is the one that's still a bit on the horizon, but is being able to have batteries as a flexible resource operate in the grid, various grid markets, on demand response programs, being able to be providing various kinds of voltage regulation and frequency response type ancillary services. These are emerging markets. In some places, they're more mature. And essentially what you're doing is you're taking the battery and being able to sell its capabilities, either its capacity as a resource for when, a local utility or a load-serving entity needs to be able to say it has some reserve power, or as a resource that meets some of these other kind of grid needs. And that's right now in California, we frame that with municipal customers as upside. So we recently have awarded a contract to evaluate adding battery storage to about 37 different public facilities in a CCA territory, which is a load-serving entity for this particular set of jurisdictions, to see can the battery provide, how much to the extent can the batteries provide benefits to the customer through those demand savings and or rate arbitrage, and how much benefit can it provide to the CCA under a model where the CCA would pay those municipal facilities an additional fee to be able to use those batteries when the facility doesn't use them for those various grid services and or wholesale procurement cost reduction strategies. So the key point here is that we're still in a place of evolution as to all the different benefits a battery can provide to a municipality. And the last one I'll talk about is the value of resilience. All these things are things that have economics associated with them, direct economics, where you're paying for the battery and you're getting a revenue back through some different kind of either cost-saving or revenue-generating strategy. Particularly in California, where we've got both the wildfire risk situation, the weather, the climate change, climate crisis generated kind of problems. We also now have a situation where our utilities, who've been held accountable for the costs of their infrastructure causing these wildfires, are being put on notice that they have to do power shutoffs, preventive power shutoffs at times when the weather and the wind and the ground conditions are such that there's a risk that they could start a fire. So, for example, last night, 21,000 customers in PG&E territory were told that their power was going to go out, and their power was shut off. Now, what California is struggling with and figuring out how to do, but is starting to do, is create incentives in their battery incentive program for public agencies, municipal agencies, who provide critical services to be able to, with batteries, solar, and microgrid islanding capability, provide emergency services during these shutoffs. Okay? So, for example, in this shutoff that's occurring as we speak, there were three, quote-unquote, community shelters that were set up that are places where people can go to have cooling, if it's really hot, to have get water, to be able to plug in cell phones, to be able to potentially get medicines because they're able to have continued refrigeration and so forth. We're doing a project funded by the California Energy Commission in partnership with a school district and their local load-serving entity, their CCA. We're going to be putting in batteries at school sites that already have solar. We're going to be putting in microgrids such that, again, their gym cafeteria areas will be able to serve as those resiliency centers during those kind of outage situations. But also will serve as one of these resources to the CCA when there isn't an outage, where the batteries, when it's not used by the school district, can provide discharges that support that local municipal CCA to reduce their cost of procurement and so forth. So there's these many different pieces and parts that come together in thinking about how can batteries be a benefit economically to a municipality. I've tried to quickly cover the range of things that are going on in California. I'll shut up now and let our other speakers speak, and then we can have some Q&A. Thank you.
All right. Hi, Jeff. I'm glad you were able to get in. We'll have to talk about why you couldn't. So anyhow, Jeff Hitzke is with Clean Focus. Jeff, why don't you contribute to this conversation? Jeff, are you there?
Sorry, yeah, I'm there. I was on mute.
okay. Well, that's
everyone.
One of the things. Before we start here, somebody is not on mute right now, and I'm hearing a lot of background noise. So would you, everybody please kind of check their phones to make sure that everything is actually muted besides Jeff. Thank you. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thanks, Sarah. Morning, and again, a little bit of setting the stage. Clean Focus is a solar and renewable energy developer. And we have a little different perspective than some of the people on the call, but we do work with a lot of municipalities and school districts and things like that to both own and operate solar systems on PPAs. So we have some insight in where the storage is starting to come into the mix here. Is we've got a couple of projects, actually, one in California and one in the New England area, where there are kind of two different scenarios. And Rick kind of mentioned this sort of economic benefits that can start to come along, and we're executing upon those in both of these situations. In California right now, we've got a project. And Rick mentioned it's a project for a CCA, and so it's not directly a municipality, but it's actually a community choice aggregator out here. And it's a case where initially it was just going to be a solar PPA, and the way the CCAs are doing procurement here in California is effectively wholesale market kind of scenario. So it's in front of the meter. The solar system is relocated remotely, relatively large system. We sell power into the grid, and the CCA buys it on a power purchase agreement at some fixed amount per kilowatt hour. So it's a quasi-wholesale type of transaction. The problem in California, and Rick mentioned this, is daytime wholesale prices are very low to close to zero sometimes, especially in the spring and the fall when solar is still producing very well, but generally demand is lower. And so any kind of scenario where we are getting reimbursed at or at least the reimbursement we're getting is tied very much to the wholesale rates, the economics quickly plummet. And so it causes a lot of problems. The main thing or the thing we're looking at right now, or the thing that actually brings the economics back to something that is a project that investors would be interested in, is doing the energy arbitrage exactly like Rick mentioned. And so effectively with a relatively large battery, 4-hour duration kind of battery, we can store most of the energy during the day and then release it at night, if you will, or in the afternoon when the wholesale prices or locational marginal prices are significantly higher. And in the right scenarios, effectively we close to 50-70% greater revenue by putting the storage on the system than if we were doing solar only. And so pretty quickly you get to a scenario where the investment in the battery makes it worthwhile. I don't know if many of you track these kind of things, but recently Los Angeles, the city of Los Angeles, LADWP, announced a PPA that's exactly structured that way. And effectively what they're doing is they've got a PPA for the solar portion of a large system, and then they've got an adder for energy that they are sourcing out of the battery. And again, the economics are driven strictly by this this energy arbitrage scenario. So, in a case where you're looking at larger systems in some cases, and again, this is primarily a California phenomenon now, but probably will start to happen more and more as solar penetration gets greater and greater around the country. This is one of the primary drivers of value for a city or municipality kind of setup that's not behind the meter. Second project we're currently working on is in New England. It's in the New England ISO territory. And here it's a different scenario. It's using the added value, and this is for a municipality, it's using the added value of the grid services or the New England ISO grid services that they're willing to pay for, and in particular, it's the regulation market. And so if you're familiar, again, it's with the wholesale operations in these ISOs, the the ISOs need to procure a certain amount of capacity and as well as the ancillary services or grid services. And the solar, again, we in New England, we can generate a reasonable return with solar only. But, you can significantly increase revenue with these ancillary services that you're actually selling into the wholesale market. So we've got a PPA with a municipality that is basically solar, not unlike the Los Angeles PPA that I mentioned. It's a little different structure, but there's a solar only portion of the PPA, or the PPA, they will give us a higher price for power that we can provide in the late afternoon and evening than power we can provide during the day. So it's kind of a bifurcated PPA rate. And obviously the only way you can do that is through solar. And we've got a contractual commitment to provide a certain amount of energy in these afternoon and evening hours. But outside of those hours, the battery is available for us to do with whatever we want, as long as we have the capacity to provide what we're contractually obligated to do. And so by procuring a larger battery and participating in these grid services markets, we can actually increase the returns on the project by a pretty significant amount, actually. The downside being is you have to be able to operate in these wholesale markets, and that's a whole nother skill and capability that most developers don't have. And, it's an area we're just really getting ramped up in ourselves. And so, again, kind of going back to what Rick said, this is very much an emerging space, and you're not going to be this isn't something that most people are going to be able to turn on in the next 6 months. It requires something to, really look at the, the long-term economics and how do you model the economics and how do you understand these grid services? This is, again, a risk that, we're seeing in the New England ISO. These grid services right now are relatively lucrative because the kind of capacity needed for frequency or voltage control needs to be, in the old days they used to call spinning reserves, but, fast response that they can provide or sink power very quickly at the signals from the ISO. And batteries are ideally suited for something like that. Well, as more and more batteries become installed, in the New England ISO, the value of those services are going to go down. And so how do you model the long-term value of those services if, every system that goes in the future has storage attached to it, suddenly the value of a storage system goes down, not unlike, the value of solar in California during midday. So it's a kind of a balancing game and a lot of unknowns and uncertainties, but I think it's clear that this is going to be happening, wherever there's any kind of significant amount of push to do renewables and solar on the grid or behind the meter for that matter. And then one other thing I would add, just because Rick brought it up, and this is something that we've struggled with for behind the meter projects, and I don't know that anyone's really come up with a good way to understand or model this, nor are people willing to pay very much for it right now, is this resiliency aspect. If you have some batteries when the grid goes out, or, in the case of California, because of wildfires or, the weather conditions in the New England area, whatever, there is significant value for the right customers in the right situations, of having, 2 hour backup or whatever the case may be. But, how do you value that? And if it's a once a year occurrence, are you willing to pay a lot of money for that once a year occurrence, and sort of like an insurance policy type of thing? And so if anyone's got any significant ideas there, that's something we're more than happy to discuss, because it's an area we're very interested in yet have no real great insight.
So Jeff, one second here.
Go ahead, Rick, but then we're going to open it up to other people.
Yeah, let me just mention that I was at a meeting with one of our California senators last week, and he mentioned that there's a likelihood they're going to put a $1 billion bond measure on the 2020 ballot for funding local governments around, quote unquote, hardening community resources around PSP, power shutoff and fire events. So I've got my fingers crossed that there may be funding coming, at least in California, with but the specific focus on local government services for the resiliency piece, in addition to the part of the what's called the SCHIP incentive for batteries, the proposal to have, you know, the incentive for resiliency in high fire zone areas. We've done an analysis, for example, of water agencies in California, and about half of their facilities in Southern California are in areas that would qualify for these higher level battery incentives for resiliency purposes. So again, that's still in the regulatory development phase. It's what's called a proposed decision, but we should have a final decision in California by the end of the year for either implementation in the winter or the spring for these new incentives for resiliency. So I'm hopeful that, you know, at least some of these public agencies will be able to move forward in those situations where the things that Jeff has talked about, the, you know, the grid benefits or the demand savings benefits don't cover the batteries, but maybe the incentive is sufficient to cover the batteries for those municipal facilities.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. So let's open this up to a few other people here who might have questions. Anybody?
This is Craig Lewis, Sierra. Can I comment on the value of resilience point?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Craig, you should have been one of the speakers here. Come on. Go for it.
I was sleeping. I've been traveling a lot, and I missed a whole bunch of Sierra's emails. So I don't even know if I was invited to speak. But in any case, you guys were great. You guys are total leaders on this and super subject matter experts. But Jeff, on the point of valuing resilience, the Clean Coalition has an initiative that we call Value of Resilience 1-2-3. And there's information on our website, the Clean Coalition website, about it. The main point of the initiative is to establish standardized values for resilience. And there's actually three values. The first one is for the critical loads. These would be the mission critical, life sustaining loads. Usually these are somewhere in about 10% of the normal load. And then the second tier is we refer to as priority loads. These are loads that you will keep on as long as you can keep them on without jeopardizing the ability to keep your tier one loads on. And usually those are about 15% of the loads. So between tier one and tier two, it's usually about 25% of the normal loads at a critical community facility. The exceptions, the main exception to that 25% for tier one, tier two is hospitals. Usually hospitals have 50% or more is in that tier one and tier two, those tier one, tier twos levels. But the tier threes are basically discretionary. People probably are not going to pay any more for keeping their tier three loads on because, you know, nobody's going to die if those go off, and pretty easy to live without those tier three loads. And usually that's about 75%. Of the loads at a critical community facility. So the Clean Coalition, we've got this value of resilience initiative. We're trying our best to work on it. We haven't found any funding for getting that, you know, into, you know, really you know, deep analysis and into, you know, helping to get all the key influencers in agreement These are the standardized values that we need to go forward with. But what I can tell you is what we found so far is that tier one loads, again, these are the critical loads, people will pay somewhere on the order of, you know, 5 to 10 times the normal price they would pay for electricity, because, you know, if those loads go off, it is you know, people are going to die. It's mission critical, life sustaining, and then the tier twos, people are going to be willing to pay, you know, 2 to 3 times the normal. And tier threes, they're not going to be willing to pay anything more than that they would for normal electricity. And when you, when you evaluate this on a net zero, if you have enough solar at a net zero site, have enough energy storage to get 2 hours of energy storage for the nameplate solar. So if you had a megawatt of solar, you would have 2 megawatt hours of energy storage. You can basically keep your tier ones on indefinitely with the level of energy that would be available, even in the worst weather day in California. That would be an average California scenario. You can keep your tier twos on 80% of the time, and you keep 100% of your loads on about 25% of the time. And so we've got that level of analysis on the Clean Coalition website under our VOR, Value of Resilience 123 initiative, and would encourage you to look at it if you want to be kind of a collaborator on this. We'd love to have you, and I'll leave it at that.
All right. We need to have a few other different people who want to contribute to the conversation. So anybody else?
This is Jerry Braun. Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, Jerry.
Thank you. I want to echo Greg's comments. The two initial speakers really provided some very valuable information that isn't generally available about energy storage, and especially it's not on the radar, I think, of a lot of municipalities, and it's really helpful to have it available and figure out how to get it out into the kind of the municipal network, so to speak. And also Craig's comment are very valuable with the, you know, the value of resilience really is a very important topic. It's not a new topic. It goes way back to, you know, when folks were concerned about disasters and how do you power emergency shelters around the country. And so it's not just a California question. So thanks very much for that, Greg. One comment would be that I think there's an opportunity to get all aspects of storage a little bit more visibility in municipal circles. Most municipalities in California already have, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of municipalities in California have climate action and adaptation plans, and adaptation, kind of another word for it, is resilience. And some of them, I think, are updating the plans, and the initial focus was really on what the municipalities could do with their own carbon footprint and so forth. Some plans did provide some direction on what the community overall could do. But I think the next generation of climate action and adaptation plans, at least in California, is going to be quite a bit more actionable and sophisticated than the previous version. So I would suggest that we try to think of a way to feed in the kind of inputs that the three of you have offered today into the climate action planning process, in at least in California. So thank you.
So before anybody else answers here, I'd like to have anybody else who wants to contribute to the conversation add in, and then we'll have go back to Rick, Jeff, and Craig. Anybody else?
Yes, Sierra, this is Lori Schell. Jeff, I just wanted to give you kudos for making the point of kind of the benefit to the early adopters that, you know, as we get more and more capacity, energy storage capacity on the, you know, on the grid, we, you know, the value of those early adopters is going to be higher than those of the later adopters. I think that's a really important point, and appreciate your having made it so clearly.
Anyone else here?
I'm not sure if Jeff's point was that. I think Jeff's point was that the developers of these battery systems need to take a tremendous amount of risk if they're betting on wholesale markets, because it's not a locked-in contract for wholesale markets. It's going to change regularly, maybe daily, and certainly every year.
True.
Yep.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. Yeah.
And
any
the point
new,
is a,
new person here? No. Go ahead.
And the point is there's a marginal, you know, the marginal return on these, putting in these batteries to provide some of these services, you know, does tail off. And at a certain point, you reach a point where adding another battery for that purpose doesn't pencil. And some research that we've done under a National Renewable Energy Lab grant has developed a tool where you can look at a load-serving entity's total load and figure out at what point does adding batteries for purposes of wholesale cost savings tail off. That doesn't take into account the ancillary services that Jeff was talking about. The point here is it is a complex of set of variables, and you know, between some of the tools that Craig has developed, we've developed, and maybe others, really important to go by the principle, measure twice, cut once. You know, don't just jump into it because batteries are cool, right? And you want to be one of the ones getting in there. It is important to do that upfront feasibility analysis to see what the secure and more speculative economics are, because you don't want to be one of those situations where you think you are going to get these benefits and then 10 years later you've lost money on the thing.
Mm-hmm. Was that Rick? I'm sorry, I didn't recognize.
Yeah, that. Yeah. Right, sorry, that
you.
Was Rick. Yeah.
Thank you.
New person. One at a time.
Whichever.
We have a very enthusiastic group of people here today. So the first person, go ahead. And who are you again? Okay.
I think we spoke at the same time the first time. So you choose, Eric. One and the other. We both talked at the same time.
Okay, go ahead. Is this Larissa?
Yeah, this is Larissa. A couple of comments.
Go ahead.
First of all,
go ahead,
thanks a lot. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we're good.
Thanks a lot, both of you. You know, great information and all. Here's just some reactions I pitch in. And Craig, too, because really following Craig's great work in this area as well. But, you know, we're talking about emerging markets and a lot of emerging here. And I would emphasize that because we got to get out of these silos. A lot that you mentioned and how things are operating in this transitional, and I would have to say transitional stage, you know, is really creating risks, great risks, and a disconnectedness in the markets. You know, in terms of your planning and predictability and all. And so I'd have three reactions here that, you know, things are only starting here with respect to the markets. I'm glad that we got the affirmation from FERC that it hasn't backed down in terms of its order 841. But this was the initial groundbreaker. I mean, there's just a lot more to be done here in terms of changing the participation models to align with the physical and operating characteristics of energy storage and to really tap into the multifunction applications of energy storage. So we've got a long way to go in terms of evolving the power markets, no less building retail markets. And I think that, you know, is going to be needed to enable really efficient investment decision making. Right now, it's just fitting into where the opportunities lie, and the opportunities are arising in a very patchwork fashion. It needs to be rationalized, and this goes back to our conversations, like Craig mentioned, you know, the market structure, the relationship between the wholesale, retail, transmission, distribution. That's got to be resolved. Until then, it is going to be, I think, a very uncertain situation. Another reaction is on the resilience. To me, again, siloed how, you know, again, climate adaptation, mitigation, seems to be separately addressed and not integrated into energy assurance planning, emergency preparedness, response, and restoration planning. And then last, big consideration to the utility of microgrids. And here, this is where I'm learning a lot from all of your projects, Craig, what you're doing. But I see microgrids as providing solutions in this by more integrating the resources. And so, like, in terms of what you said, Jeff, that, you know, concern that as the distributed resources proliferate, the value is going to go down here, more risk, you know, unpredictability. But with microgrids, you can, not just aggregate them, but manage and optimize them to increase their value even when they will proliferate in the future. And also microgrids, how they can enhance the value for communities in using these assets through their systems approaches. So those would be my reactions, but really thank you for all of your information and experience.
Okay, whoever that other person was who was trying to speak at the same time, go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
Hi, that was David Kay, and I just had a question.
Sure, go ahead, David.
Okay, so I'm wondering how much, you know, if the people who have been, who are obviously very knowledgeable about these topics could distinguish the considerations that are really site-specific around storage from those that are sort of timing-specific, utility-specific, company-specific. If that makes sense. Specific location, the specific location and of both the where this facility and the storage will be, and its relationship to the specific entry point into the grid.
Got it. Yeah. The locational the question of the locational benefit comes down to the way various markets are set up, both around pricing, you know, use of the battery to address wholesale cost management, and also in relation to some of these grid services, to what extent, you know, you have capacity issues that are greater or lesser, that is a consideration in terms of the value of those batteries in addressing those capacity issues. I am not the person to answer all the details of that question. I have engineers who know about that stuff. But definitely there is a locational piece in regards to both the pricing question and the grid benefit question. And there are companies that are, you know, developing tools to do that kind of analysis. One such company is called Kavala, which has a tool that called Network Assessor Tool that looks at, you know, down to the distribution grid level of where, you know, there are capacity constraints and therefore where location of a battery, say, could have greater benefit to help relieve those constraints. Now, for that to work, you have to have a grid operator, who is, friendly to a distributed energy resource approach to these things. That's the other political side of this that we didn't talk about, because there are, various mandates at state and other levels to increase the side-by-side comparison of distributed energy resources versus otherwise known as non-wire alternatives to traditional grid approaches, many utilities in the country are structured so that they have incentive to do the more expensive traditional approaches versus the non-wire alternatives, because generally non-wire alternatives are less capital intensive and therefore their return on investment to the utility is significantly less. So you got to deal with both of those issues around, working the question of taking that locational benefit and making the case with the entity that's going to pay you for that benefit and what their interests are.
Thank you.
This is Jeff. I'll add to that. I mean, there are a little bit, there's some efforts going on to actually formalize this a little bit in the New York State, New York ISO. They have incentives that actually have an adder for certain geographic areas where there are, you know, needs for the grid, either for storage and or more capacity. And so they're trying to incentivize development in those areas by, you know, adding to an incentive above the base level incentives for storage, for example. And but it's, you know, it's a very, they're typically, you know, very much substation or a couple of substation type of things. So you either have to have a pretty intimate knowledge of the area you're in, or, you know, you're not going to even know, and for a municipality or a school district to say, hey, wait, I'm in one of these, you know, higher value areas, they're unlikely to know that unless, you know, a developer or someone comes to them and says that. And that, you know, to me, it's an interesting opportunity where someone like, you know, NYSERDA in New York could go to these different municipalities or whatever the case may be and say, hey, look, you are in an area that requires or needs more support on the grid. You know, let's try to move development along in your area and, you know, be a little bit proactive about it. And at least to date, I have not seen that that's really happening.
Jake had a comment on this, you know, going, I forgot, Jeff, who came before you, who was talking? Was that Rick?
Rick, that's Rick. Yeah, it's me. Yeah.
You know, Rick, I guess I have this question for you. Gee, I've been giving California so much credit for all the work on, you know, the hosting capacity, the locational net benefit analyses, and then how that's a factor into demonstrations. What I'm hearing from you is that, like you said, there are all these mandates, but I guess California has not really addressed the utility revenue model sufficiently to kind of create or align the utility's interests to be able to then take advantage of the work being done on the locational net benefit analyses, hosting capacity. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that, and just to be clear, you know, it's one man's opinion. I would like to see that. I mean, there are things happening, but, you know, it's going incredibly slowly. And, I mean, there are these different proceedings with the California Public Utilities Commission, some different pilots. But, honestly, the PG&E bankruptcy has pretty much taken a lot of the air out of the room on those things. people are wondering, you know, so when we talk about the economic model for utilities and you start talking about, well, we can put non-wire alternatives. We can put batteries at, you know, water treatment plants and, you know, police stations and whatever, really cost effectively as a alternative, you know, way of deferring more expensive distribution asset investment. You're also talking about reducing the return on investment to that utility that's now in bankruptcy.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. But it's not just the bankruptcy. See, what I've seen is that California has really been the leader in terms of what we've been discussing, developing more consistent methodologies by the utilities for evaluating host capacity, the net locational benefit analyses, et cetera. But what I have not seen California do, that, of course, New York hit home, and that's right targeting the utility revenue model and trying to equalize CAPEX with OPEX, the performance benefit. And so that's interesting that if you don't attack that, if you really don't start transforming that, you're not going to be able to take get the benefit of all this great work that California's doing.
No, you're exactly, that's exactly right. I couldn't have said it better.
This is Craig. I have a question for and kind of a comment on the question about how to value this at location specific ways. You know, Rick, you spent a lot of time in your upfront commentary, and Jeff hinted on this as well, that the, you know, so much of the value is tied into the rate structure, right, which would make it utility service territory specific, right? That's going to make a big difference in terms of what the valuations look like and what rate tariffs are available.
Right.
And my question, you know, kind of with that comment, my question to Rick
and Rick, Jeff, and anyone else, is do you have, can you point us to the best examples that you know of for case studies that show how the economics work for putting solar in storage at these critical community facilities? I know that Rick works in that area, you know, a ton. I think that's the primary business model for Terra Verde.
Right.
And then, and maybe more specific question for Jeff. It sounds like Jeff works more on the wholesale side. Jeff, do you have a case study, or could you point everyone to a case study that shows how these wholesale markets are working or not working? You did. You were very clear that these wholesale markets are not for the faint of heart and very treacherous. But if there's anything that either of you have that provides some really clear examples, that would be greatly appreciated. And I just add one more comment to the, or one more nuance to the question for Rick. Rick, can you answer, is net metering, I hear different answers on this, is net metering with the investor-owned utilities, is it now monthly true-ups? And if so, how did that affect the overall value of net metering in general?
Again, Craig, I apologize. I believe that is the case, and one of the issues is that a lot of the projects that we've done are still in that grandfathering phase under net metering 1.0, this is the problem of becoming too high up in an organization, you lose touch with some. Specific dynamics.
I totally get it. No worries.
I can't answer that. I don't think it's degraded things that much. I mean, in some of the pro formas I've seen recently, that hasn't been the critical issue. The more critical issue has been, obviously, the TOU, the peak period shift to the evening. The true up hasn't really had as big an impact in the ones that I've seen, but I'd have to get back to you. In terms of resources, I can send Sierra some blog posts that we've done that kind of describe these kinds of dynamics that I've talked about here. We also have some information on the wholesale market side because of these research grants that we've gotten from the California Energy Commission and the National Renewable Energy Lab. We've been writing up some of the research we've been doing on, not the ancillary services stuff. We haven't, but things like RA and day-ahead market, real-time market pricing, and also very importantly, and this is something that we didn't talk about, but I'll just do a quick thing on, California is changing its methodology for measuring emissions of renewable resources to what's called Clean Net Sure, which essentially means we're going from measuring a emission based on the annual GHGs of a portfolio to an hour by hour. Like, what is the actual GHG emissions of the resources that are being deployed on an hour by hour basis? And that's going to really, reduce the amount of GHG-free energy that's calculated on behalf of our utilities, our CCAs, or municipals in the next couple years. How do you address that? You have to address that. The only strategy that I'm aware of is by using resources like batteries, charge them with clean solar in the afternoon, and now discharge them during those periods when the sun goes down or the wind isn't blowing. Absent that, it's sort of goofy to say that somebody's got a 100% or 60% or 50% renewable portfolio if the only way they're getting there is buying a REC from somebody else or, some way of accounting that you've got, GHG-free power, but you actually haven't delivered GHG-free power. So batteries are going to be a critical piece of that equation, and I think that'll be a game changer in the right direction in moving, at least in California, going in the right direction around the value of batteries. So I just wanted to add that little piece. And I'll send out a little study that we did on that question to Sierra so she can distribute that to the folks.
Awesome.
Yeah, this
we have
is Jeff.
A couple minutes.
I'll just add on resources. I haven't seen anything really definitive, if you will, or a really good quality white paper or something. A couple of the storage companies, in particular STEM and NG, have some things on their websites or, you know, that they make available. In fact, I think if I recall, NG also had a webinar on storage in the New England ISO and how to monetize that with grid services, if you will. So there are some resources out there, but I can't point to one definitive thing.
All right. We're just about out of time. No, go ahead. Let me just say one thing. If anybody wants me to send anything out, it needs to be today because I will be out of town for the next 5 days. So go ahead and send it along, and I'll try to get it out this afternoon then. Go ahead.
Sounds good. Sierra, this is Jerry Dameron, and really appreciate all this great information. What's really clear is integrating storage into any municipal scenario requires a great deal of expertise, and I'm intrigued by what I believe it was Rick was saying about feasibility studies. It seems to me most municipalities are not going to go to the trouble to study 10 white papers and really understand this. They're going to need expertise in the form of feasibility studies where they can understand, okay, someone's going to show us what our parameters are and what our nuances, what our regional considerations are, what is the general cost and the general time frame for delivery of a feasibility study to a municipality to help them make these.
Yeah, I'll just give you a real quick answer, and then I know we have to go. Again, it depends on the number of meters you're evaluating, right? How many different sites you have. But generally for a city or a school district that has anywhere from, say, 10 to 100 meters, it's going to range anywhere from $20,000 to $75,000 to do a good investment grade. This is the key part. You know, something that a finance company will buy off on, an investment grade feasibility study. I got to go, guys. I'll send out to Sierra some of those blog posts. And thanks for inviting me.
All right. Okay. It's on the hour. And so thanks for everybody for attending. We've got a couple of really interesting conference calls coming up in October and a webinar. So keep your eye open. I'll be sending out the invitations shortly to the conference calls particularly. And thanks for everybody for coming. Thanks for Jeff and Rick and Craig for participating in the content and in the discussion. And hope to see you all next time.
Good. Thanks, Sierra.
Thanks, Sierra.
Everybody.
Thanks.